Welcome to another episode of The Working Title, hosted by PJ Harries.
Yeah, just send it to whoever. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, write it off the tax. Awesome, Hammy. So, welcome to The Working Title, mate.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast. It's great. I've been following it a little bit. It's pretty cool.
Thank you, mate. Thank you. So, to everyone listening, this is Charlie Hamilton. He is, I mean, it's really hard to lock this down as to if you've heard the other ones. I try and go, oh, he is a da-da-da-da-da-da. And this one's quite difficult, but this is what I've broken it down into, all right? So Charlie Hamilton is an author, business owner, a motivational speaker, former RAF, and a traveller/adventurer. How does that work?
I like that. That sounds good. That's okay. Yeah, it's inflated my ego, so it's good.
There you go. That's your new Twitter bio.
I'm going for it. Yeah, I like it. It's good.
Awesome, mate. So when people are listening back to this, I'm probably going to refer to you as Hammy. That might confuse a lot of people, but that's what I've always known you as and what I've...
It's a name I've not heard in a long time.
I bet.
That's what you know me as.
We're literally saying before this podcast, it's been like 9 years since we've actually spoken in person, which is just too long.
Crazy long.
So obviously I know who you are, mate. And I've just given a quick, brief introduction. But to everyone out there that may not have heard, give us a little rundown on yourself, mate, and what you've been up to.
Oh, that's a tough one. I think, like you said, it's difficult to put that into a single category. But yeah, I'm ex Royal Air Force. I had a fantastic upbringing until about 16, when all the house of cards tumbled in, and it was really difficult until about 22. So I was still in the Air Force at the time that all these things like came to a head. And I suffered quite immensely, I think, from a lot of mental health issues that I didn't deal with at the time. And from all that adversity, I found a way to grow. I found a ferret called Bandit. This ain't made up. Anyone listening that doesn't know about Bandit. And this is normally where people hang out. They're like, oh, this guy's pulling my leg. I then decided that I'd go and better myself, and I left the Air Force. That's the first way I bettered myself. And I bought a camper van and hit the road with my ferret, and as you do, represented a lot of different charities, raised a lot of funds for different projects and charities and things like that. And as you mentioned, I've started my own business in Bandit's honor, named Adventure Bandits, and wrote a book about all these struggles that I mentioned. So I'm an author now, which is a pretty cool thing to say. I'm going to say it again because it makes me feel good. I'm an author. How sick's that? And I started writing my second book today, which is just mad.
That is absolutely crazy, mate. So awesome.
So I'm out of a bit of pitch, right?
yeah. It's almost like you talk for a living. Let's go into it, mate. Let's delve straight in.
See how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Exactly, yeah. So let's start right at the beginning, mate. So you said you had a good childhood. Whereabouts was that? And talk us just very briefly through the good childhood before the age of 16, before it all started going a little bit dodgy.
Yeah, I had a great childhood. Nuclear family, two older sisters that helped bring me up as a gentleman, I like to think, and a real loving mum and father who were together. And I think they had difficult times financially and with their marriage and stuff like that when I was quite young, and even before I was born. But by the time that I was about 15, they'd really sorted all of that out, and my mum was doing really well with her career. My dad was doing really well with all the strange things that he was doing with all the antiques dealing. And you remember my house, it was like a museum.
It was mad.
And that was in Essex, that was in Hockley, next door to Rochford, where you grew up. So I've always been interested in aviation, and I joined the ATC and met you when I must have been about 13. I originally joined a different squadron to you, and then we went to Clambeda. I'm not sure if you were at Clambeda or not that first time, in Wales, but that's where I met the likes of all the gang that we used to hang out in, and
the crew.
Yeah, and that's kind of the crew, yeah, and that's where our relationship started. So yeah, I had a really I don't know how I'd say my upbringing, just really calm, really nice, really I was well mentored. I had a lot of older people around me who helped me out a lot. I had achieved quite a lot of stuff when I was that age. I was always doing things that I wanted to do, and everything was just going swimmingly, and it was like, right, well, I'm going to join the Air Force as soon as I turn 17 and go in as air crew, and that was it was all just written out, you know, school, college, Air Force, retire, you know, quite young, and just enjoy life, really, and there was just no inkling of any difficulty that would ever come up in my life at all. And that all changed pretty much overnight, really.
When you were in that period, you were essentially following the rhythm of life. You know, it was all going well. Everything was stepping up to the right place. Everything was falling into plan.
Yeah, yeah, cool. I mean, I was a kid, so everything's kind of, I wouldn't say it was written for you, but you're very guided as a child, and that's really important for our development. You know, with our psychology, and the children that I work with now, they don't have that, and they've not had that for a long time. So I've worked with children from 4 to 18 that have not had a stable home, that parents aren't about, who've seen domestic violence, maybe they've had it happen to them as well, and that then shapes their life immeasurably. Their mortality lowers, their chances of being in prison goes up, and things like that. So luckily, in that time where I was being formed as a person, all these values, it's called mimetics. All my memes, my mimetics, are from real good mentors and parents and role models and friends as well. That's also a really big thing. So yeah, you're kind of told what to do by the people that are around you. You do grow into your environment, you do grow into the people that you hang out with, and it was all good. In fact, it was great. But things change really quickly, and and that's kind of what happened next.
So that gets us up to date. Just before we move on to the more of the gritty stuff, your aim to join the RAF, that was in the mind, that was from a young age, and that was sort of what you wanted to do.
Yeah, from I've been told that from the day I could talk, you know, from when I can actually form words, I've always pointed out aeroplanes. And my dad was a military collector. My granddad was in the Air Force. I was kind of raised on Battle of Britain and Bridge Too Far and all that stuff. They don't make them like that anymore. I was raised on that. It was just natural that was what was going to happen. And it wasn't like, oh, I'd like to be in the Air Force. If you'd asked me then, oh, what do you want to do when you're older? I'm going to be in the Air Force. That's what I'm going to do. And I think just being in the military full stop was the bottom line. Like, that was the standard. My standard is set at, I am going to be in the military. But the Air Force is where I was aiming at.
Awesome. So, little Charlie Hamilton hits 16, and we're going through the motions. It's all looking good. Then what happens?
So it's actually really cloudy, because in my book, I say how the things that I struggled with and the difficulties that happened to me are not special. I don't think I'm special. I've not, you know, been in a massive gunfight in Afghanistan or Iraq. I've not been kidnapped and abused. I've not had anything like crazy traumatic happen to me, and that's kind of why I didn't feel worthy of having like a mental health problem, because all the things that happened to me were really normal. You know, first thing that happened was a really messy divorce that I was dragged into. I was actually, I think I used the term in my book, I was weaponized. So I was used by my mom to get back at my old man. And that's when things started going wrong. So that was in, that was Christmas. So 16, so the Christmas 2000 and 2011 or something like that. So yeah, I was 16 at the time. And I'd just gone into college and I absolutely hated college. And then my mom and dad breaking up and things like that. It was just like, just a really, there's never a good time for that to happen. But for someone that was quite fixed on what I was going to achieve and that I'd go to college and then, you know, go and be a air crew or a pilot or something like that, to then have this stumbling block of, not only do you hate college, but now your parents are using you against each other and they've broken up and, you know, the whole support system just collapsed. I found myself quite isolated quite quickly. So that's the first thing that happened. And that really intensified over the year. So that was the first thing, like that complete support just fell away. And there's so many people whose parents get divorced, and it never really occurred to me how much of a loss that is until it happened to me. Like I had friends that had parents got divorced. I mean, I think your parents are divorced, weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's sort of one of those things, as you say, yes, it is relatively routine in the day and age that we live in now. However, yeah, to build that up with all the other experiences you had of a negative kind, that's when it really starts to affect people, doesn't it?
Yeah. And the thing was, is it wasn't just a, you know, clean cut, like you're not going to see your mom and your dad anymore, or you're going to see them at the weekends, and I didn't have that time to establish that as a kid, like, oh, okay, this is normal, mom and dad don't see each other, and that's all right, because I see them at this time and him at that time. There wasn't any of that. It was like, your dad is scum, and whenever I saw my dad, it was like, your mom has lost the plot. And I was then dragged into all their arguments and then used by my mum against my dad and things like that. And just lied to. And when you're lied to by the ones that you trust the most, like your real rock, your parents for most people, or your guardians, when you're lied to by them, it's like, well, where do you turn to? Who do you trust? And at that time, when you're an adolescent and you're developing these skills and learning about the world and what you want to do and where you're going and things like that, that's a real critical time to not be messed about with. And that's exactly what happened. I was messed about with. Yeah.
That's mad. So you were going through college, not really getting on with it, not really enjoying it. The messy divorce happens. Then where do we lead on to next?
I remember quite well. I walked into school and I was like, no more. It was sick form. So that's why I said school, because it was like my old school. I did really well at school. A's and B's across the board. And college, I just did not get it. I started parachuting. I started flying. I knew that I was going in the military. Stuff at cadets was getting pretty good. I was really enjoying like all the competitions we used to do, like Falklands and stuff like that. I just had a keen mind for anything
military,
muddy and shooting and camaraderie and all military stuff. And I was just so fixed on that. My support had gone, and I went into school and I was like, look, I'm leaving. And they were shocked. My teachers were shocked, and like, they were like, but how are you going to go to university? And like, oh, you're not going to get a job. And you're not, just feeding me all that crap, which at the time, I think if you would have said that to me now, I would consider it. But at the time, I didn't even give it a thought. I just thought, no, this isn't right. It was very spontaneous. Like, no, I'm not doing this anymore. I don't enjoy it. And I'm going into the RAF without qualifications. And that's okay, because I know that I can do that. Because at the time, you didn't need A-levels to be aircrew. I don't think you still do. So that's what I did. So I remember walking home. I called my mum. Mum, I've left college. And that same afternoon, I called the recruitment office. I was like, right, sign me up. And that started a 3-year process of getting into the RAF. It took a very long time to get unusual long time.
Yeah, why did it take so long? I mean, the journey into the armed forces is different for everyone, depending on a lot of different things, whether it's medical or application process and things like that. You said yours took a long time. What were you doing in the meantime, and why did it take so long?
I went to work at Southend Airport. There was a cafe there, if you remember, called B-52, I think.
Down the back of it.
Yeah, it doesn't exist anymore. I think it's a car park now. But I went to work there. That was my first job. And I'd go to cadets and then walk to the cafe and get changed there. And I absolutely hated that job. I really, really didn't enjoy it. It was one of my first official, like, on the books jobs. And I think I had about 20 jobs between then. Between leaving college and getting into the RAF, I did about 20 different things. It was insane. I was always doing something different. Of course, the financial crisis 2008 really like messed things up. And also the fact that I was coming out of college not too long after lots of people didn't even go to college. So all the jobs for real novices like me were gone. So I was doing anything and everything to get work. And the whole process into the armed forces was hindered by their complete inability to organize anything, as you'd understand.
Mad, isn't it?
It is just like, how on earth do we manage to get a jet into the sky, troops to a foreign country, or even just bloody bullets in the right magazines? You know, it's just insane. How incompetent the whole process was, getting passed around pillar the post, and depending on who you spoke to, it was depending on what would happen next. You'd speak to one person and they'd say, oh, well, sorry, we have to close your application. You speak to another person, they'll go like, oh no, don't listen to them, we don't need to do that. It was like, well, you know, it was just mad. I can't really explain it. So the first year there was a problem. They were cutting air crew. And that's when one of our friends was cut, if you remember rightly.
So
they closed my application for that, and that was finished. The next application was, I think I went for RAF Reg, and there was a problem with that. You can tell by that point, 2 years into this awful time, not just with the divorce, but by this time with a gentleman who turned up on the scene as well, which we can talk about later. I was desperate. You know, I needed to get out. I needed a job. I needed to get away from home. I needed like my identity back, and I needed to not be reactionary, not like on survival mode, but I needed somewhere to be. And I knew that I needed to get into the military, and I was just like so focused on that. And I think the third application, there was problems with it, but it all went through. It just took so long with just handling errors. Like, they lost all my application and I had to start again because they lost my application. Problems with like my medical. So there was no medical problems, but they were really, you know what it's like, they're quite intense, and they only really want someone to be quite perfect when they start training, so that they can mess you up afterwards. That was it. So I was doing everything, and I was like polishing airplanes, cutting grass, cleaning houses, DJing, if you remember. I used to do a bit.
Yeah, I do.
I worked at a plastic bag factory. I cleared snow. I worked for a company clearing snow. I bought and sold stuff. I did a bit of time in Dorothy Perkins and South and High Street. Man, I was all over the place, surviving.
So for those 3 years, what we're going to do is we'll finalize these 3 years, then we'll go back and talk about what you just touched on. But after those 3 years, you got into the RAF and started training with them, did you? That was the start of that journey.
Yeah, so at the end of them, at the end of that real tumultuous time, I got into the RAF, and I thought that this is it, done it now, gotten away from all them problems, it's all over, I can just be me, everyone can leave me alone, and I'll just retire in 25 years with a decent pension and live on the beach somewhere. So that's how I saw it going from then, because I'd achieved finally that thing that I. It wasn't like so much as, oh, I need this because of this is who I am.
It was happening.
I'm coming here to do this. It was like I needed it to survive because of things were not cheery outside of that not happening. I don't know what I would have done, actually. I've never actually had to think about that until now, what I would have done if I hadn't got in. I mean, I'm sure it would have all worked out, but
it's always
pretty good.
It's always good to have that focus.
You're looked after, you're supported, you know where your money's coming from, you know where you're sleeping, you're always going to be fed. Like, what's the worst that can happen when you're finally in? You're going to get looked after.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
I think that's what I needed. I needed that.
Awesome. Yeah. So the whole gentleman on the scene thing, or the other guy on the scene, he comes up later anyway in the story, if I remember correctly, doesn't he? He's sort of as a background to one of the other incidents, or as a contributing factor sort of thing.
Yeah, I think so. He but on in a big way. So I get really confused at the time scales because so many things happened. But this must have been about when I was. Just turned 17, so just turned 17 because that's when I got my car. Do you remember my Mini?
I do,
That we used to bomb around in, and you drove it. You were the first person to drive it.
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, that was fantastic. That was a good day. You were there when I got my car, and
yeah, and it was a brilliant day actually.
Yeah, that was a really good day, and you asked. Oh, can I take it for a spin, Mrs. Hamilton? And he took it for a drive down the road. That was sick. That was such
so
a good car, wasn't it?
It felt like a go-kart.
It was a go-kart, yeah. And I really enjoyed that. That was cool. And so then finally I could cruise around with all the bigger boys in their cars. And I had a little Mini. And do you remember having a pancake fight? I'm not sure if you were there for that, but we used to party a lot, didn't we? Like a lot. I look back now, I'm thinking, I couldn't have had time to be miserable. We were just out doing stuff all the time, like buying random drinks, ripping the labels off of it, and pouring them into big bowls.
Mystery drink X.
Through our nose. We used to do loads of mad stuff, didn't we? So we used to like bum around each other's houses and like find different parties and go on ghost trips. Did you ever go on one of them? Like ghost hunting trips?
No, I don't think so. I think
Essex.
By the time we were hitting that point, I'd already, I was already.
You may have already been. I think so. Yeah.
So
it was during that time then that my mum started seeing a bloke.
Yeah.
Who was wonderful, a really nice guy. And we moved out of the house in Hockley, and we went to a house in Rayleigh. Which is probably 3 miles down the road or something, and that's when things started to go south. So he moved in, and it was short time after he moved in. In fact, it was April Fool's Day, which is ironic, that my mum had a really bad stroke, like a severe stroke. I mean, when a lot of people have strokes, they go to hospital. Maybe there for a week. Sometimes they can be there just a couple of days if it was a small one. She was in hospital for 6 months, and she was only she was in her 40s when it happened. So it was quite extreme what happened. She'd torn an artery in her neck, which caused a blood clot. So she didn't even know it happened, and it happened when she was asleep. So that's when I was on my own, still trying to contemplate all the hatred I had for my dad, which I sort of made up with him, and how I was so poorly led by my mum and like I said, weaponized by her for our own gains. And then, I was then on my own with this dude who did not turn out to be who he made himself out to be. And that was the descent into a very slippery slope. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, because at that stage, I believe, I can't remember the date, but that must have been sort of around early 2012 into mid 2012, because I was either in training and going through training, and I was at my first unit, because I remember when I could, because I was so focused on my own goals and my own things going on, and I remember sort of having conversations with you at the time of sort of like by text and stuff, which was like, and I just remember finishing the text going, I can't do anything. Like, it was just like, I'll be like, you all right, mate? Oh, how really? You getting on? And the response would be, yeah, all right. You know, not too bad, just cracking on or doing this, doing that. And I remember finishing it going, well, I know it's not. I know it's shit, but I can't really help out.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was sort of like, well, I was just out of the way.
Yeah.
It was a bit shit.
That's nice that you mentioned that. It's nice to sort of be in a position now where you can look back and think, oh, that's what was going on there, because I've managed to do that with all these different people. Of course, this is the first time we've spoken in almost a decade, so it's quite nice to hear what you were thinking as well, and that you knew that things weren't cool. That's quite poignant, because of I had a lot of family members that could have been there that weren't. If you knew that it weren't cool, they knew better than anyone that it weren't cool. But yet still I was on my own very much so
definitely
a long time. But like you said, with my text saying, yeah, all good, just cracking on, I was cracking on. I was completely like span out. I didn't realize I was suffering anything bad at the time, but I clearly look back now and be like, yeah, there was problems then with my mental health, but I didn't seek any help, because of I think I was so focused and so militaristic that I don't get help. I am the help. I am the leader. I am the, you know, I've got to do this, and I'm going to do it just to spite you, to spite everyone that like doubted me, you know.
Yeah.
So I didn't afford myself any time to go, you know, I need some help. And that was a mistake to do that. But obviously, this is the thing with mental health, is it's still taboo. You know, people don't want to talk about it, and people don't want to go, yeah, I've got a problem. Or and that is exactly what happened to me. Except, I mean, I must have been 17, 18 at that time. So to do that at that age, when you're still a child in the eye of the law. At 17, you're still a child, and you're still meant to be supported. Most people still are supported, Jesus, until they're in their 40s. But to have nothing there for my health and my support at home, that was that was quite a lot. So it's quite nice to hear that you knew that there was something more to that as well. That's quite kind of reassuring in a way, actually.
Yeah,
even though you couldn't do anything and you may feel bad, it's reassuring to hear that perhaps you wish you could have, or
definitely. And
you knew me well enough to know that there was something that was wrong.
And we've chatted briefly to some of the other lads as well in the circle, and I think there's a general consensus around the whole period of time that we, although in our minds we tried to be there as best we could for you, and this was the start of your issues, so it was sort of like we sort of tried, but as young kids, essentially, as we were, with own stuff going on, it's only later reflection, I think the general consensus is, although we tried to be there at the time, we probably weren't there as much as we could have been. And as kids, that was probably all we could have done.
And I wouldn't have expressed, because if I didn't express this, I didn't express this to anyone, really. I only ever came out about it when I was in the Falklands, when it was like when things had gotten proper crap, like quite a few years on, but like 4 years on from then. And that was the first time I ever went, yeah, things are really bad. And you think all that stuff had just gestated in that time. It just like cultivated this awfulness. And that I just incubated it, you know. This was the problem with what happened when I went into the military. When I was in the RAF, you're with the lads, you're tough, you're doing PT every day, you're flexing, you've got loads of money to spend at the pub, chasing women, and you know, like complete like red blooded egotism, and like that's just what like, it comes as part of it, especially when you're a young male.
Yeah.
But you bury the things that you need to deal with under that, and that's not good at all.
It's not healthy.
And I've spoke to a lot of blokes and women that have had the same experience with the military. The fact that they've got to be someone, they've got to lead, they've got to be there for their comrades, they've got to, and you know, it's quite interesting the fact that I can't talk from a perspective of, yeah, I had problems because of I've been blown up or shot at or done some things or seen some things, whatever. This is something different, but I've been in that situation where I've been in the military, but not having suffered from an activity from the military. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting. And that was another problem that I had. I didn't feel like I was worthy of that. I felt pathetic because of, you know, there's so many heroes out there and so many blokes that have lost their lives and given their lives and stuff. Well, because my mom upset me, you know, I'm a bit sad. Yeah. You know, that's how I felt. But there was like two parts of me. There was the part of me that was like, what is going on in my head? And the other part of me that was suffering immeasurably.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't let that part that was suffering get treated. I wouldn't tell anyone about it. It was like almost like a split in me. And I think nowadays it's sort of looked at as a high functioning depression, where you can be someone and you can do things and no one would know there's anything wrong with you. But yet you're tearing yourself apart inside, you know.
So let's bring it back to the timeline that we're working through then. So at this time, your mother's just gone through the stroke. You're still suffering. You're on your way into the RAF. And now you've found yourself just spending a lot of time with this guy that's on the scene, essentially meant to be looking after you. How did all that play out?
Yeah. Not very well. I think within a couple of weeks, I started working for him. He paid me like, I don't know, like 20 quid a day or something to do all sorts of stuff in his business. As soon as my mum got ill, he stopped paying me, and I felt obliged to keep working for him, not for him, but for my mum, because it was their business. And I then, what happened next? I got an old Hoover. I was donated like some car cleaning products, and I put it all in like a trolley. I'd crashed my car, my little black Mini. I wrote it off, and I was trying to get enough money to fix it up. I crashed it near the KFC, where is that area? Do you know what I'm talking about? Near the park. What's that place called? I can't remember, but it's a road that we'd always go down, and where the KFC was.
Yeah.
I don't remember the name.
I think I'm following
anyway,
you.
Yeah.
By the Bell Pub.
I think so.
Yeah. Anyway, carry on.
Anyway, that's going off topic. So I was just like desperate again. Still, like, I'd now lost my only source of independence. My car. I couldn't see my mates. I had no money. So I couldn't even get a bus. So I started cycling everywhere, and I just dragging around this trolley with all these car cleaning products, knocking on doors. And on my first day, knocking on doors to clean cars, on my first day, I earned 50 quid, and I felt like a millionaire. Like, I'd not seen that much money in ages. And I got home that day really happy with myself. And as soon as he came through the front door, he said, me and you need to talk. You need to start pulling your weight around here. You need to start contributing to the house, blah blah blah. And it was like, well, hang on a minute, you know, like, I've just been working for you for nothing. And as soon as I started like fighting back, he grabbed me around the throat. And that's when things just it was just in that small well, it's not a small thing at all, grabbing someone at the throat, but it's just in that one event changed everything. And it was like, this is no longer, oh, I don't like living with this bloke. This is now like, oh God, what am I into now? What's going to happen? It was quite scary to think of in a way, because I mean, I didn't want to like beat the bloke up. I didn't want to like, you know, kick his head in or anything. What can I do? He was paying for the roof over my head. It was like a kind of Stockholm syndrome where it's like, right, I've got to live with him, but I can't because he's like physical and violent and stuff. He's going to be looking after my mum. I've got nowhere else to go. Like, what do I do? So I just started fighting back, and then whenever he would give me negativity, that's just exactly what I'd give to him. And then that just made me even more and more miserable and just grumpy and horrible. And I'd start doing that to other people. And it was around about that sort of time that I lost contact with all of you. Because I think every day in my mind, it was like, right, what am I going to come home to? He's just walked in the door. What's he going to do? Where am I going to get my money from? How am I going to do these things? What are my family doing? I was really confused. My family weren't doing anything. And it was just like, I've just lost control. Like, what's happening? I couldn't like process it all.
It's a lot going on for a young mind, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I think at the time I thought I was big and tough and yeah, but now you look back and you're like, man, you were just a kid. And I think I've got to get over that. I think I'm still working on that to a degree, like this idea that I kind of feel guilty, like, well, I'm 17, I'm not a little boy, like, you know. But actually, you might be really young at that age, and all these role models and that are coming into your life teaching you things at that age, it's really important. You've not yet learned to be selective of whose advice you trust or who you listen to or whatever. So it was quite a lot to take on. So especially with my mom not being there and all the previous stuff, like, it just started snowballing, you know.
Yeah, it's really starting to build now, and I know
it's starting to build.
Yeah. So to keep it moving and make sure we don't eat up too, as I say, there's so much we could delve into about all of this stuff. No, but we need to
start talking about your ferret yet.
I know, that's the fun part.
I'll try a bit better with that. So I eventually my mum came back home. I think we had some cracking parties in the meantime still. So I was still seeing people occasionally, but just not the same. Things weren't the same with me at all, understandably now. And then my mum came back. We moved again to a better place because she couldn't talk. She couldn't walk. She had to relearn who we were. She'd completely forgotten who we were. You know, when someone said, "This is Charlie, this is your son," she looked at me like, "You're not, I don't know who you are." And that's a lot to deal with as well. And so she's moved back. There's this bloke that I know is like, he is not a good person to be around. He started turning the rest of my family like against me, telling them things about me that just weren't true, and things that I'd done, things that I hadn't done, whatever. And eventually he says, he comes and knocks my door early hours in the morning and says, "Oh, I'm leaving. You and me aren't getting along and it's not fair." And I was just like, "Oh, okay, fair enough. Like, thanks for being a big man and coming in and saying that. I really appreciate it. No one's told you to stay. That's fine. I can look after my mum." Because I was sort of looking after her, you know, like washing her, feeding her and clothing her, which is another bloody difficult thing to do, actually. And then he left. He came back a little bit later, like a few days later or something. And a couple of weeks after that, he did the same thing again. He left. This time he didn't come and say to me, "Oh, I'm leaving." He this time blamed everything on me and said that he can't stand me. "I'm this, I'm that, blah, blah, blah. I'm leaving. I can't look after you because he won't let me. And I'm not going to come back until he leaves." So it was like, I can't believe actually anyone believes this guy. Like, how is this adult spinning all these lies about me? And how comes everyone believes it? So that night I was told, basically after a massive argument, that I had a choice. So he left because of me, and I need to start changing my ways. And I said, "Well, actually, what I think is he's left because he's seeing someone else." And my mum sat in silence the whole time, and she didn't say anything. It later turned out that he was seeing someone else, and she knew that at the time, but wouldn't defend me. not because she couldn't talk, because she could talk a bit, but so I decided then, I was then told, if you leave, he'll come back and look after her. Now, I was going in the Air Force, so I knew that someone had to look after her. I couldn't look after her. But yeah, if I stayed, he wouldn't come back. So it was like emotional blackmail. Like, if I stayed, he wouldn't come back and look after her when I went into the RAF. If I left, he would come back and look after her. I didn't have a choice, so I left. And I stayed in Hockley Woods for a bit, which is a woodland right close to where we used to live. I really liked the outdoors, and I think a lot of the way I bettered myself and helped myself out mentally was through the outdoors. And I think part of that was probably staying a while, like transient homelessness in Hockley Woods, staying in my car and just getting my head straight. It actually felt immediately better. As soon as I left and went into Hockley Woods, it was like, I'm back in control. I had a bit of money in my pocket from some jobs that I'd picked up. And it was like, right, I'm actually in control. I've got nothing. Literally, I've got nothing, but I'm in control. And that felt really good.
Well, you see it quite a lot later, when you go to deprived places, you know, some of the happiest people in the world are the people with nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. A little while later, I was taken in by my best mate's family, and that's where I would call their sofa home for the next 3 years. And then a short time after that, I went into the RAF. There were so many things that we can talk about that happened, like fights with him and calling the police I had a fight with him in the garden on like a bank holiday when everyone was outside cleaning their cars. I was in my pants on top of him on the grass, like giving him what for. It was crazy, just crazy time. That basically takes us all up to what happens next, really, with the RAF.
Right. Yeah. So as I say, I would love to spend longer because there's so much in there.
So much, isn't there?
And I know other little stories and bits that were happening with random fires on different things and things like that. But anyway, right, let's get to where we are. So you joined the RAF. You've still got all this stuff going on back at home. How was your sort of transition from civvy to military, and how did that sort of progress through your RAF career?
Training was easy. Easier than easy. I think some of the cadet camps we were on were harder because of the instructors on the cadet camps were like narcissistic and they loved it. Do you know what I mean? You know the types. They loved it, didn't they?
Yeah.
You're like, please, you're not even a weekend warrior. You're a youth worker, for God's sake. But then in the RAF, it was different. When they were grumpy and angry, it's because they were training you. And, you know, it's just a game. And there was about 100 people on my intake, and I was one of two that didn't get any poor scores or any like training reports or, you know, all that kind of stuff. Nothing. I was one of the best. I think I was also the second best shot as well. It was easy. I loved it. It was great. And like, I think it's because I'd done 7 years in the ATC. Like I said, I'd done harder cadet camps than training. And it weren't like it was easy. It was actually really hard. It's really intense, you know, just the tempo of it all, and like the amount you're sleeping and the amount you're learning, and like you're on edge like all the time.
You know, you're living up to every stereotype that every other military force has of the RAF right now, right?
I absolutely agree with you. But what I was going to say, but not the combat stuff. That's the only difference. Like the combat stuff was like, you know, a couple of weeks, and it was just more like a laugh, really, not gonna lie. But the other stuff, like just changing that tempo and stuff. But you do say about how other stereotypes of military. You had duvets, didn't you?
Duvets?
Yeah. Did you have duvets?
What, in training?
Yeah.
We did.
Yeah, we didn't.
Well, you had an itchy blanket.
Yeah.
That must have been horrible for 4 weeks.
It was awful. You wouldn't understand. Horrible. Horrible for like 30 days. Oh, you weren't there. You wouldn't understand, PJ. You wouldn't understand. But no, like, you know, it's just... it's not just the physical side or anything like that. Of course, it's not intense as the Marines, but it's all the other aspects that you got to consider, like all the social side and like where you fit in with all these strangers, and like someone's just like completely messed up and now you've got to be friends with them but at the same time hate them and all gel as a team. And oh god, it's just like, it's weird, isn't it, getting your head around what life is actually like. And it's just a bit weird, isn't it? It's difficult to explain, really. I loved it. I thought it was piss. I really enjoyed it. And same with the RAF as well. I really, really enjoyed that. It was easy. It was just too easy. I think that's the problem with it.
Didn't challenge you as much as you expected.
You turn up, and the other thing is I was putting tons of effort in. I was doing like force development trips, like making like history trips and stuff around the UK, and I was doing that on my own, and I was getting the same recognition as some idiot that would turn up drunk, you know. Yeah. And I just thought, what am I doing? Why am I wasting my time here? So I really, really enjoyed it. It was super, super easy. Got so much out of it. Did some really interesting stuff. Glad I went in. Glad I came out. And you know what? The hardest bit was itchy blankets.
Oh, lovely. Lovely. Right. Awesome. So
you did get duvets, though.
Yeah, we did. It was brilliant. I don't even know why that's a bad thing.
I'm getting mental trauma about my itchy blanket now. I've got to stop the interview, Pudge.
We didn't ever use them, mate, so they were lovely duvets to iron. You don't sleep in recruit training for the Marines, so don't worry about it. Right. So you're traveling through, you're enjoying your RAF experience, you're frustrated by the fact that obviously, you know, other people are getting paid the same rank as you, but absolutely not performing to the same level. What was happening back home? Catch us up to, assume we're at the end of your career in the RAF and you're starting to think about transitioning out. What has triggered that and what's happened in that meantime back home?
I can't get my thoughts back. Right, so back home, the dude started to just be really horrible. I weren't allowed to see my mum anymore. She didn't want to talk to me. All these other things were happening, so like we stopped talking for a while. So eventually we started talking again, and my mum said to me, just as I was about to go out of the Falklands, "Oh man, you weren't there, the Falklands, pff, hardcore." we didn't have blank, we had itchy blankets there as well. A day or two before I went out of the Falklands, I rescued my mum from her house. She was like, he's abusing me and this, that and the other. And we were like, right, let's get her out. So we cleared her house out, grabbed the dog. Remember the dog? Oh, man. Yeah. What a legend.
What a dog. What a dog.
And it was a dog indeed. We cleared all that out and moved her to some other guy's house, like a family friend. And like we were like, finally, we've got our mum back. We can see her and we can help her, blah, blah, blah. That next day, I got a call from my sister saying he's called her up saying, "Where are you? Where's all the house gone?" And I still think that's hilarious, you know, opening the door and seeing nothing in the house.
Everything's been cleared out.
What he would, that would have been mental. Anyway, and my sister had told me that my mum had said to him, I'd forced her to move.
Brilliant.
I have no idea why she did that. And in my mind, that was just like the nail in the coffin. After all the things that I'd done for her, all the emotion that I'd brought into it, you know, saying like, he's abusing me and things like that. And to a degree, there were some things that didn't add up and some things that I think he'd assaulted a nurse. He'd assaulted someone else. Like there was more police involvement. So it was like, right, this is serious. Let's get her out. And then just to go back to him and blame it all on me, it was like, what on earth is going on? I then went out to the Falklands and I was BFA, so Battlefield Ambulance. I was away from my trade. I sat in a empty crew room day in, day out, waiting for a phone to ring. That is what I did for 4 months. It rang 5 times in 4 months.
Wow.
So I did one job every 3 weeks. And there was a good library there, and I just watched every documentary, read every book. I learned some German, but still, your mind starts wandering when you're sat in the same room for 4 months, waiting for a phone to ring. And that's when I saw the film The Revenant.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a scene in there where DiCaprio gets his like throat ripped open and he starts breathing funny. And it just really reminded me. Well, it didn't remind me at all. I can't really explain it. All of a sudden, I was in the cinema. There wasn't many people in the cinema. And all of a sudden, I was just like thrown back to her bedside, and like seeing her struggling to breathe and basically seeing her like close to death. And when I came out of them thoughts, I was like wet with like sweat, and I was shaking and my fists were like gripped, and I don't use the word in the book, but it was all I can say is it was a flashback. I just went back there, like physically. I wasn't. It's just like this most bizarre thing to explain. And I'd already started self-harming then, because when I found out my mum had like just completely betrayed me, I was numb. I just couldn't feel anything. And the only thing I could feel was pain. I couldn't feel love. I couldn't feel happiness. I couldn't feel, you know, I could smile, but it didn't mean anything. The only thing I could feel was pain. So I used to cut the inside of my arm and my upper arm. And then this thing happened in the cinema, and then it was happening more and more frequently. Like it happened again and again. And then I'd have like panic attacks where you just sat there and all of a sudden you're like, I've got to go. I've got to run. I've just got to, and it just comes from nowhere. It's like the weirdest thing to explain. And I just felt so pathetic and weak and just awful. I found out as well that my mum was then deteriorating, and she'd had more strokes since I'd been away. I'd not spoken to her. And that's when I just decided that I was going to write my suicide note. And that's when things became really serious with like self-harming and my thoughts. I was like completely out of control. Like the sensible part of me was like, come on man, get a grip, like pull yourself together, you'll be all right, like this is nothing, you got this. The other side of me was like, no, something is seriously wrong, and you've got to get someone to help you, or you're not gonna, you know, you've written a suicide note, like you. And I was dedicated, you know, that was going to happen. I was looking for opportunities to do it. It weren't just like, oh, you know, I'm gonna write this just in case. It was like, right, I'm gonna write this and then find my moment.
While you were still in the Falklands?
Any time, really.
Yeah. So you writ it while you're in the Falklands, but you were as soon as the opportunity comes up.
Yeah, as soon as it comes up, then I'll check out, is what I said.
I mean, it's very efficient of you.
It was very efficient, yeah. I was looking for methods and things like that, and there was no real tall places to jump off, or, you know, I was like, maybe I could hang myself, but then, you know, I was working at the hospital, and I was real good mates with a lot of the people there, and they'd be the one that'd have to deal with me dead, and do I want that? And you know, it was like I was making a problem out of my problems, you know. It's yeah. The weirdest thing. I think that's just something that I used to do a lot of, just feel guilty for feeling guilty, which made me feel more guilty, or feel bad for feeling bad, which made me feel more bad. And it was just everything I would do was just a vicious circle. I started working out a lot, like intensely. And that, again, was just self-harm in a different way. Because I would just break myself. And I'd also box a lot as well. And I'd like hurt my hands a lot because I wanted to, you know. All these just little different manifestations of how I can just express myself to myself and get some feeling out of myself. I didn't want anyone to know I was doing it. It weren't like an attention thing at all. Like I said, I felt pathetic. You know, it's like there's some blokes that don't have itchy blankets to sleep under and have duvets. I've done some hardcore stuff, and I just didn't feel like having a label like, oh, you got some mental problems. I didn't feel like that was for me. Eventually, I tell my mates what was going on, and I said, I can't do anything about it because I don't really think I've got the courage to. Will you do it for me? They did. Soon enough, I was chatting with the Padre. That was great. Who then told my boss. And my boss was like, right, what's the matter with you then? Come on, young man, like, what's wrong? And I was like, oh, nothing, sir. He's like, do you want to go home? Is that what it is? And I was like, no, I do not want to go home. That is the last thing I want right now. And he's like, right, well, we can stay here then and, you know, stiff up a lip. And it was like, look, man, I just need some love. Like, for God's sake, like, treat me like a human being.
Yeah.
And that's what the problem was, you know. Everything was just so efficient and military and just, like, this is the case with all of these children and adults, and the children I work with have behavior problems, and a lot of people call them like naughty kids or whatever. But when you find out the psychology and how their brains are working and things like that, you realize, oh my God, this person just needs another human being. And that's just what I needed. I needed someone to go, oh, come on, man, like, let's work through this. I didn't need someone to go, come on, stuff up a lip. I then got checked out by the doctor, who said, this is going to end your career. And I said, great, thanks for telling me. Don't really have a choice because you're making me do it anyway. So I got checked out by him, who then referred me to the GP in the Fort in Stanley. I went down there and it was like, oh, do you want some flyers? I was like, oh yeah, great, cheers. You know, that will stop me hanging myself. Maybe I can use the flyers to give myself some paper cuts or something. Like, it was crazy. Like, I'm telling them that I've written a suicide note and they're like, oh, here's a flyer. Oh, cheers for that. I got home and I stopped self-harm, and I actually met a girl who really, really helped me out. Actually, we don't talk anymore, and I don't suppose she likes me very much, and that's cool. I'm all right with that. But she, yeah, I've got a lot of love for her. And I stopped self-harming, but the panic attacks were still there. The flashbacks are still there. I don't like calling it that, but that's kind of what it was. And I just still carried on looking for just ways to end it all. It was around that time that I found out that my mom had motor neuron disease and she'd got about 3 months left to live. And we didn't know that she had motor neuron disease because of she was had a stroke. So the symptoms of the motor neuron disease was masked.
Similar, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But she was deteriorating and no one knew why. And by the time I worked out why, it was too late. And I saw her just one time before she died, because of the tension of the family, because of my mental state, because of everything that was going on. I loved her. I knew I loved her. I didn't like her very much. I'm happy to say that. But I loved her a lot. And I don't need to see someone to know that I love them. And I determined at the time that seeing her wouldn't have made anything better. And I still believe that. Now I'm much better. I've written a book about it. Like, my head is screwed on. I'm helping people going through these same things now. I still would not change what I did. I still wouldn't have seen her. I saw her about 2 weeks before she died.
That was the way you were dealing with it. And you were so happy with that. Which is good. That's the only thing that matters. Is that you are
And maybe
happy.
I'll change. Yeah, maybe I'll change my mind when I get older. But, you know, I nothing will change the fact that at that time I was doing what I thought was the best given the circumstances and given everything that I've learned at that time.
Yeah,
that you've, was just you've the made best the I right, could do, and I can't. Yeah.
Yeah, you made the right decision with the information and how you felt,
yeah,
and that's what you can ever ask for, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what happened. That kind of brings us up to, you know, there was a couple of suicide attempts, and in fact I was kind of planning another one when I got the call that my mum had died. And that was an interesting night actually, because I got on my motorbike, I went to work, and they were having a beer call, like just a piss up at work basically. I went in and all the lads were like, hey, Hammer Time, because that's what I was called, Hammer Time. Yeah, it's a good one. I think it's better than Hammy, but I don't know, I like them both. Hey, Hammer Time. I was like, all right, lads, way, mum's just died, way. So I went into the office and was like, look, I'm not in work tomorrow. My mum's just died. And they were like, what are you doing here? Like, go.
go now.
And I went outside and they were on my motorbike and the keys were in it and they were pissed and they crashed it. They crashed it into a work car and it was like, no. So they'd like wrote it off and I like had to like run with it so no one would get in any shit. And like the damage, it was like, oh, I don't know how that damage just got there on that car. Well, we don't know. Mental. Anyway, I went home that night and I saw the next day in the room, like the grieving room at the hospice. The hospice was wonderful. All the family members that didn't like me very much, or who I perhaps thought should have been there for me, the ones that I kind of felt like they kind of disowned me or could have been better knowing what had happened. They were all in there and they looked bloody miserable, rightly so. Their daughter, sister, niece has just died. But that weren't my style. That weren't me. And I think you know that that weren't me. You know that that's not how I handle things, because of, like you said, when I was going through stuff and you knew that I was like, yeah, I'm all right. You know, that's just kind of, it was just a front. I'm always like a social hand grenade. Just because I was like suicidal and looking for ways to kill myself doesn't mean I was missing out on the opportunities to get drunk with my mates and like having a laugh. And no one could quite believe it when they found out that actually during that time I was suicidal, even my family. But I just remember looking at them thinking, I'm not going to handle this like they are. I'm going to find a way to make this a good thing. And I feel like crap. And my insides look like their outsides. Do you know what I'm saying? Like my insides look like their faces.
Yeah.
Their attitude, the way they're holding themselves, their tears, their grieving was how I looked inside. And I just remember thinking, I am not going to do that anymore. And I went for a walk that afternoon with Bandit. And I just went, right, Bandit, we're going for a long walk and we're getting our head straight. And I've kind of introduced a new character without properly talking about him, but Bandit was my ferret and he used to love going out for walks. And that's when my life changed, when I decided I'm not doing that anymore. That's what other people do. Looking like you is what other people do. Acting like you is what you do. And that's just not me. And I'm going to go and do something.
And that's when you made the decision.
That is when I just, it was like that. Just simple. I'm out. Done. Like, there was no more suicidal thoughts, no more depression, no more self-harm, nothing. It was just done right then and there. Finished. Quite profound. And there was no medical help, no more leaflets, nothing. It was just all good. But when my suicide attempts were stopped by Bandit the ferret, because one night I just thought, oh, I've had enough. I was driving a work car middle of the night in rural Lincolnshire, looked around, no other cars, there was a bend in the road ahead with some trees, and I thought, right, I'll undo my seatbelt, and I stepped on the accelerator aiming at the trees and just closed my eyes, and I suddenly thought, oh god, I didn't feed Bandit. I'm on nights and I've not fed Bandit. And if I do this now, who's going to feed Bandit? And who's going to look after Bandit? And I skidded and I missed the trees. And that happened a few times in different ways. Like there was a bridge as well. And I just remember thinking, if I do this now, God, who's going to look after my ferret?
Such a mad thought, right? A mad little thing,
mad,
isn't it?
Mad thought. Just mad. And that was enough. And there was other times when I'd like just go back to my block and just lay on the floor, just like unable to function after a whole day of trying to smile. And he'd just come and like, I don't know, just chill out with me, like sit on my lap or play or like want to go for a walk, or like he kept me alive because he kept me. He was my meaning. My meaning was ferret stuff. Walking ferret, feeding ferret, playing with your ferret.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like a euphemism.
Oh, it's great. Great chat up line. Oh, hey, ladies, I got a ferret. You want to see my ferret? and that kept me alive, you know. Craziest thing.
So to keep this rolling, you've built this relationship with this ferret, and it really sort of stood out and clicked you out of that hump. After your mum passed away and you went to clear your mind with Bandit.
Yeah.
At this point, was that when you decided you were going to leave the REF? Yeah.
I'd kind of decided already. When I was in the Falklands, I was like, nah, this ain't for me. Like, I just, it's insane. I was watching every day, like, on Houses of Commons debates about, you know, cutting funding to the MOD. And I just thought, you bastards, you know, like, I'm sat here with my itchy blankets and you're discussing cutting my pay. Why on earth would you do that when so many young blokes and older blokes and young girls and older girls are giving large portions of their life to be to the control of, you're going to live here, you're going to fight there, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. And like, you're talking about taking away more of our money. I just thought, this is insane. I went to my superiors, that I told them I was going to leave, and they went, oh, no, don't leave, go through for your air crew selection. So I was like, okay, I'll do that. So I went through for that, and I met lots of pilots, and they just were just saying, it's shit. It doesn't get better just because you're flying a jet and look like Tom Cruise. Don't mean it's a better job. You're still just a number. And I thought, yeah, I think you're right. It's the same for me. And that's when I left. In fact, one of the things I said to my boss was, I'm fed up of wearing black socks because I just want control of my, like, why does it matter what color my socks? That's how like annoyed I was at the whole thing. I was like, what black socks? Why does it matter? I remember one NCO like pulled me in front of the warrant officer because I weren't wearing issue black socks. They were like Tesco socks or something. I thought, like, you tosser, like, what? Why are you wasting everyone's time on it? So yeah, that was another thing. And I've not worn black socks since. First thing I did was buy rainbow socks. So
just because you could.
I'm wearing right now candy cane socks, and they're brightly coloured because of I'm not wearing black socks again. #, I'm not wearing black socks again. So that was when I was like, right, I'm coming out. And I walked across Hadrian's Wall with Bandit for Motor Neuron Disease Association, 5 days up from my mum's funeral, which was bizarre. Like, that's a whole other Skype chat we can have about that. Mental. Anyway, I was out by the beginning of May. But, I mean, I wasn't doing anything from April to May anyway. I mean, I was just chilling out, you know, what you can do, fire me. So I was just getting on every course, getting any Gucci stuff I could before I went. And, yeah, that's about it. And,
so you, yeah, I was once you left,
officially out.
Mm-hmm. So once you left, you're all sorted. So what I'm going to do is, I think it's going to be best if we... if we try and, because there's so much still to talk about.
There is. I'm really sorry that we should have written
don't
down.
Be.
Like,
don't be sorry, mate. I've been keeping you on track. But let's.
Thank you. Let's.
We've still got a bit of time where we can make it work. So let's go into as keeping it as brief as possible, because no doubt there's a million and one stories. But you decided to go on a big adventure with Bandit. How did that come about?
I started working in recruitment and I loved it. It was great. I'd was progressing. I really enjoyed it. I had a great manager. I had a girlfriend that we lived together in Nottingham. We had a really nice flat, actually, really nice 2-bedroom flat, big lounge, garage. I had 3 cars. I had a hot rod. I had a wartime Jeep and my modern car. I had stormtrooper armor. I had a massive telly. You know, like, I was just like the boy, you know, loving it. Like, I had everything that you could wish for. I had a famous ferret. I'd started to get like a lot of BBC interviews and having quite a good profile with talking about mental health and charity events and stuff like that. And my girlfriend, I got home one day and she weren't there. And she just decided that she didn't want to stay together anymore. I'm not sure. I never really got to the bottom of that, but whatever. And I just then started thinking, oh, what do I really want? You know, I've got everything and I don't really feel like I'm very happy. What do I need to do? And that really messed with me for a while. Like, I'd felt suicidal. I felt like I didn't want to live. And I knew what that felt like. I started to feel like I want to live. And it was almost as powerful as I don't want to live. But do you understand the difference between I don't want to live and I just want to live?
Like, yeah, they're quite, it's that similar, experience,
but
isn't it?
Very, very different. And I was just so desperate to live and smile and have fun. And And I just remember sitting at work one day just thinking, this is just not me. I'm just not wearing a suit every day guy. This is not me. And I've got more to offer the world. I've not come this far to come this far. And I just remember saying to my boss, look, I don't think I can do this anymore. And he got it. And that was cool. And he gave me a week. I said, I've made up my mind. I've got to leave. I bought a camper van, sold everything I owned, and
hit the road.
On a hell of a road trip with my ferret Bandit. It was during that time as well that I met my current other half, Kiara. It's her birthday today. I met her a month before I left Nottingham, and and that's how it started. And we did it to raise awareness for a charity called Save Our Soldier. And it was just like the most maddest thing. Literally sat at work thinking, I want to go to the Arctic Circle. And then, you know, a couple of months later, I was there. Not even a couple of months later, like a month later, I was there. I had no ties to the UK. I had nothing. Just anything that would fit in my van. Sold everything. And I had no job to go back to, nothing. And it was just so alive, so fulfilling. And seeing the Northern Lights and driving all that way, it was just mental. I was looking at the weather today from where I was in the Arctic Circle two years ago. It was minus 13, I think it got as low as where I was. And I got stuck in some serious snow at minus 13 with my ferret watching the Northern Lights. And that was just mental. I'm not really sure why that voice said go there, but things are working out pretty good now.
Yeah, because of
what
it.
I'm doing.
Yeah,
for sure. So we drove from there, met my other half. I convinced her to come out to Berlin. So we stayed in Berlin for a while in the van. 10,000 miles through Europe, every major city pretty much, and then down to Sicily. And that's where I gave my van away. I gave my van away in Sicily because I wanted someone else to enjoy it. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to give it away to someone. And we flew back with Bandit in the cabin of an aeroplane. Pretty mental. And a week after we got back to the UK, Bandit passed away. So it was like the perfect little story. Like the perfect little adventure. We'd climb mountains together. We'd walk around Pompeii. We won awards together for our charity work. Like he saved my life. Like he was a rescue ferret. And I like to think that I rescued him, but he kind of rescued me as well. Most bizarre conversation, this, isn't it? You know, talking about a ferret saving someone's life.
It really is, but like, what a life for that ferret. The impact that
he's
had. I
know, man. Like, he had a passport, 15 different countries if you include the Vatican City.
The world's most travelled ferret.
I reckon so. I don't know if that's official, but
the unofficial world's most travelled ferret.
Unofficial. Yeah, you heard it first. So awesome. That kind of like rounds off all of the history, and now it's just like what I'm doing now, really.
I think that's good. We're gonna have to do another episode, because we're gonna have to do another episode where we just chat about your actual time while you're traveling. We've got a great background now of who you are, why you decided to go where you were, and the impact of Bandit on your life. Before we round it out, then, let's have a quick chat. What are you doing now? You know, what things are on the horizon and what's happening now in your life?
I'm waiting. I've actually got 5 minutes time. Well, 10 minutes time, something like that. I've got a meeting at a local secondary school to work. I'm a bushcraft instructor now, so like doing your Bear Grylls kind of stuff. I was an instructor in the Air Force, and I learned also how to do it with children when I left the Air Force. So I started my own company where I teach troubled kids like confidence, social skills and things like that through bushcraft. So I've got a contract with a secondary school locally, a primary school. I also do parties and stuff like that for more fun stuff when it's not coaching and youth work. I've just published my first book, all about the stuff that we've just been speaking about for an hour. And my philosophy is it's quite deep, and I think helpful. I wrote it as a manual to my young self. I can't give it to me back then that I can perhaps give it to people now. And that really makes me feel great, especially as it kind of went viral. It sort of blew up pretty mentally. It was in like Cosmopolitan, Japan, Russia, speaking on radio shows in Dubai, speaking in like New York, and mental stuff going on. Apparently I'm like semi-famous in Brazil somehow. I don't know why.
That's insane.
And I don't know. Literally, I woke up and my phone was like on fire. Maddest thing. And earning
Lad Bible.
Lad Bible. Yeah. It was funny. Like people were messaging me like, "Oh mate, you've made it. You're on Lad Bible." It's like, dude, I wrote a book like last month. You didn't say I made it then. I think that's more impressive than being on Lad Bible. You know
what? Nope. But yeah, I'll take
it.
It's great.
Lad Bible's got. I won't knock it. I know. Weird. Whatever. But yeah, I'm selling lots of copies of my book, which is great, and like signing books and stuff. It's pretty mental. It's really really humbling, actually. And I've just stared for about half hour at a blank Word document, thinking, oh, I've got to do another book, because there's something inside of me that's just pulling me that way. And it all went good when I listened to that voice that said, go to the Arctic Circle with your ferret. And I just do that now. I just listen to intuition and just follow it. And that's led me into youth work, coaching, motivational speaking, writing, and being bloody happy, like all the time.
That's
my
the
default
biggest thing.
It's like the weird. It's weird. Like, I think people's default is like somewhere between like some like comfortable misery, and they go up and they go, oh look, I've just found some happiness. Oh god, I'm back here again. Oh look, there's some happiness. Oh, and I'm back here again. Whereas me, it's the opposite. I'm like, oh, I'm happy. I'm really good. Oh, there's a little bit of sadness here. But that's all right. I'll come back. Oh, I'm back, and I'm back where I'm gonna be. You know, and I've had to learn that like a really hard way. And that's just where I'm at now. I live on a boat. I'm off grid. I'm really happy. And
that is amazing.
You know, it's taken a lot to say that actually. And if I put my hand on my heart and said, if I pop my clogs tomorrow, there's nothing that I've not done that I said I'd do. I've done a lot of a good full life, and I'm 25, man. You know.
That's insane.
So much
that is
more.
Insane.
So much, and I sincerely mean that, and I think that we've all got the ability to do that. I know we have. I know we've all got the ability to do that. And there's some things, you know, there's some medical conditions and mental conditions, but I think with the right guidance, the right help, the right experiences, and the right state of mind that can be cultivated, I think we can all feel like that. I think there's a problem with society, especially when you look at the fact that the leading killer of men between teenage years to 45 is suicide. In one of the world's richest countries, most abundant countries, most well-connected countries, with all the medical professionals that we have, all the help we can get, that should not be a fact.
No,
there's something
really
wrong
shouldn't.
With that. And that's kind of my mission, is to curve that any way I can, you know. If
Incredible.
I just reach one person, then great, you know. But let's hope I reach a few more.
That's it, mate. And, you know, speaking to you has been brilliant. I'm really glad that we had the chance to do this, and we're definitely going to have to do it again. To reach out and see some more stuff.
Yeah, please get someone more interesting first. Give your audience someone more interesting, less depressing, and then we'll come back.
Weirdly enough, you had one of the sort of the longest stories, and you're a guy from the RAF. Most of the other are Marines, and they haven't got as interesting stories. So
that's because they didn't have itchy blankets.
Or a bandit.
Or a bandit. Yeah, or a bandit. But yeah, man, I've
awesome,
got
mate.
So much respect for the armed forces. I'm quite critical in my writing of the armed forces, of my experience in the armed forces, but the general soldier, or like the individual airman, sailor, pilot, frogman, whatever, in the military, I have got enormous respect for. I think it's just an incredible thing to give your life to a service of some kind. And I really appreciate your speakers that you have come on to your show. It's really good. You're doing awesome. Good work, Pudge.
Thank you, man. Thank you for listening. That makes one.
Yep.
in the very unlikely event, and hopefully it does, because, you know, there's so much information there, and it's always good to hear it from the horse's mouth, if you like. Let's give a quick plug. Hopefully someone listens and then goes out and buys the book. What's the book's called, and where can they get it?
It's called Before Our Adventures. It is on Amazon. It's 5 stars, and it's got more than one review, so it's not like a biased 5 stars. 5 stars. It is £10.01, so you don't have to pay postage because it's over a tenner, because I'm kind like that. Or you can buy it as an ebook for £5.99. Believe it or not, I get paid more for ebooks, so do what you wish.
Buy the ebook, save the trees. Also, and so people that want to follow you day to day, obviously I know you live off grid, but do you have any social media or websites that people can keep a track of you?
I do. It's charleshamilton.com, because I'm vain like that. Or on Facebook, it's Adventures with Charles Hamilton. And on Instagram, it's Charles Hamilton Inspire. You know, I just love my name, you know, it's what it is.
Yeah, it's a good name. It's a good name. I prefer Hammy or Hammer type, but it's a good name.
Yeah. Yeah, well, whatever, you know, whatever floats your boat.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Hammy. You've been a great guest. Hopefully get you on soon.
Thank you so much. Cheers, dude. I'll catch you later.
See you soon.
It's been emotional.
It really has. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Working Title, a podcast hosted by PJ Harries. Remember, do something that makes you just a little bit better every single day.